and Norm Shealy. NormShealy.com. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Christian DeQuincy. And Christian's going to interview me. It's going to be a little bit different tonight, but he's going to interview me, and we're going to talk about consciousness and philosophy of mind. How are you, Christian?
I'm very good. I'm looking forward to an interesting conversation tonight.
I have to tell you, I'm a little bit nervous doing it this way, but
yeah.
I trust you. So before we get started, why don't you tell us your website where people can find your books, too, because that's kind of what led me to asking you to do this.
Okay. it's very simple. It's my name. It's www.christiandequincy.com, and DeQuincy is DeQuincey, so ChristianDeQuincy.com. And I'm also information about my work at the Wisdom Blog, which is thewisdomblog.wordpress.com.
Thank you. So for those of my listeners who don't know about me, again, my name is Eva Herr, and I host this radio show every week. And I wrote a book called Agape, The Intent of the Soul, back about a decade ago. And I had a mystical experience, which kind of changed my life. And when I woke up, I was different. I viewed the world differently, and I had medical intuitive abilities. So I kind of wanted Christian to help me tell my story about consciousness and what are the things that I learned in this experience and what it's done for my life and how it might can help other people with their lives. So, okay, Christian, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay. Well, a place I would like to start, and first of all, let me just say that I'm intrigued about the conversation we're going to have, because it's going to be a conversation between a mystic, a medical intuitive, and a philosopher, and we each use different gifts in terms of how we relate to the world. In the case of the mystic's gift, it's mostly the gift of intuition. In the case of the philosopher's gift is the gift of reason and language. Now, each of us have all of those gifts, but it'd be interesting for me to see how we blend these two in this conversation this evening. Where I would like to begin, Eva, is to a two-part question. The first is if you could describe the circumstances around the transformative event in your life that turned you from who you were before that event into becoming a mystic and medical intuitive. So what was that event? And also, if you could just say a little bit about, if you can remember, describe what you were like pre that event, and then what happened after that?
Yeah, that's a frightening thing to have to really go back and face what I was before, but I'll do it. Okay, the thing, let's see, tell me your first question again.
Okay, it is to describe the event, the turning point,
okay,
the transformative event in your life, and then just say a little bit about who you were before and who you were after that.
Okay. I think what kicked it off was I had had a very dark night of the soul. And what I mean by that is in 6 weeks, I had had my son kidnapped by a family member, my mother, as a matter of fact, that person that is supposed to nurture you and take care of you. And I got pregnant, and my father died abruptly, wasn't expecting that at all, and I lost my job. So within 6 weeks, I got pregnant, and my mother kidnapped my son, I lost my job, and my father died abruptly. And my father didn't have anything to do with the kidnapping. But it sent me spiraling to where that my nose was on the pavement, and I really had no place else to look but up. The event happened overnight, but it didn't happen for about 2 years down the road, which interestingly enough, every mystic that I've ever, well, I won't say mystic, but every person that I've ever talked to that's had a mystical experience, and they all ironically happen to be scientists, have said somewhere within the previous 2 years before they had their mystical experience, they had a really dark night of the soul. So 2 years seems to be important. And it was about 2 years after I had the dark night of the soul that the shift occurred. It happened in my sleep. I thought that my father, who had died abruptly, came back to see me. And I thought that I went to the other side. And when I say the other side, I guess it was like a near-death experience without having to die. Whatever it was, whether it was a dream or whether I really did that thing, I don't have a clue, and I wouldn't even know where to, you know, how to validate that, except that it was real to me. Mm-hmm. And when I woke, well, while I was there, I learned things and I saw things that helped me understand that the way that I had been raised up, which was as a fundamental Baptist, wasn't really the way that I think that it really is. Mm-hmm. I think when I woke up the next morning, I understood life from a non-dual perspective, that we are one with everything, that there is no mass on the quantum level, that there is just pure energy, whatever that energy is, and information. And I knew people that I didn't know before I went to bed that night. Specifically, it was Danyon Brinkley and Raymond Moody and Norm Shealy and Caroline Mace, who I've come to know since that time. And that's kind of ironic because all of those people aren't the easiest people in the world to get to know because they're all kind of a bit reclusive and different themselves, but we've all became friends. And I was a housewife at that time, so I really wasn't out in the world. I mean, I went to the grocery store and I went to my kids' school, and that was pretty much it. So there was nobody in my life to talk to me or condition me or to make me think these things. It just came out of the blue when I woke up. And it made me change the way I treated other people because I realized that we are only one energy, and that if we are one energy, then that we are everything that we see and think. And that was a profound thing to happen to me because when I grew up, or in my earlier years, like in my 20s specifically, I really wasn't a very nice person. I mean, I was an attractive woman, and somehow I got caught up in politics in Alabama, where I'm from, and power and money were the things that were important to me. And I mean, I could pick up the phone and call the president. I could pick up the phone and call the governor, and I wasn't a nice person. It was all about me. What could I do for, you know, what other material thing could I have that would make me appear to be better than somebody else or more than someone else? And when this thing happened to me, all of that went away, and that wasn't important at all. I could care less about any of it now.
And it literally, even though you said there was like a two-year incubation period through your dark night of the soul, in some ways it's also something that happened overnight, that you went to sleep one night and you woke up in the morning, and when you woke up at two levels. You woke up from your sleep, but you also woke up in your life.
Yes, and it literally did happen overnight, but it took me, I'd say, a good 5 years to really understand it and grasp it. In fact, I actually checked myself into a mental hospital because I thought, okay, I woke up knowing all of this stuff and I woke up having this medical intuitive ability, and I think that I can see for about 10 years into someone's health future, and I have about a 95% accuracy rate. Well, that's frightening when you start knowing things like that. Mm-hmm. And I also knew not only what they were going to have, but what to do with alternative or some kind of natural form of, I don't want to say medicine, but I'm going to use that word because I don't know another word to use, mm-hmm. to cure it or fix it. And if they would just do this thing, then it either wouldn't come, the disease wouldn't integrate into the body, or if it wasn't already here, or either it would get well. So I thought I was going nuts. I thought, okay, you know, it's after everything that happened with my child, because I hated my mother about that. Literally, I hated her. I thought, I've fallen off the edge of the cliff and I've lost my mind and I need to get some help. So I checked into a mental health facility, and they did a real good job at reinforcing into me that something was wrong with me. So it took me, you know, and I didn't know anybody else that was like me, so I didn't know what to go read about. I didn't know about people like you. I never heard the word consciousness. I didn't know that people could, I didn't know about psychic things, really. So it was literally like being shocked awake.
Well, this is probably valuable for your listeners, because I'm sure that, I know that the kinds of experiences that you're talking about, although they're not well publicized in our culture and in the mass media, I just know from my involvement in this work over the years that actually these kinds of experiences are not nearly as rare as people often assume, that many people throughout the States and throughout the rest of the world have those kinds of experiences that you've just been talking about. And because they're not recognized within the dominant culture, people tend to respond a little bit like you did. They begin to question their sanity. And actually, what really has happened in moments like that is you became more sane. You actually woke up to the different levels and richness of reality that most of the time, most of the people are blind to. And it's only when you woke up to that, you then became aware of other colleagues in the world, like Daniel Brinkley, Carolyn Mace, Norm Shealy, who also, and there are lots of other people out there who do this kind of work. And so it's important for people to hear your story, to know that actually this is not something that's pathological. It's actually of great value to you and to the people that you come in contact in life, and that's true of other people as well. So I encourage you to keep on telling your story.
You know, I've never heard it put that way, that it actually made me more sane, but that's exactly what it did.
Yeah.
It made me understand really who I was. And one thing that I think helped me a lot was being able to have this radio show and find out that other people did have this experience, because every single one of my family and friends ostracized me at the time and wouldn't have anything to do with it, because the devil did it to me, they said.
Mm.
The devil did it to me. But since that time, I met Edgar Mitchell, you know, and at Noetic Sciences. And one of the things I learned through his group was a study that Cassie Veeton and Marilyn Schlitz and Tina, I think Amarok is her name, was a study they did that said, and I can't remember if it was 20 or 30 years long, but it was a very long study, that starting in the early to mid-1990s, there have been more spontaneous awakenings like this than ever before in the history of time. Now, how they know that, I don't know. But what it does tell me is that I'm not alone.
Yeah.
And almost everybody that I've talked to that have had one of these experiences, it happened in the early to mid-90s, which is exactly when it happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it tells me that something's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's something, and everybody gets the same message, you know, that the world has too many people in it. You know, something's got to be done. We've got to start paying attention to that. Not that having people and babies are a bad thing, but that we only have so many natural resources.
Yeah.
You know, what to do about that, because they will only last so long. Number two, that thought is really the only thing that exists. And when we think about constantly warring, and we got to go fight with this country, and we got to go fight with this race, and we got to not like the Mexicans, and we got to not like the Muslims, all that we're doing, since everything that is thought, is feeding the energy behind the negative thought, which is ultimately going to bring us down in civilization. Everything. Because, you know, thought is just simply energy I mean, things that happen is simply energy placed. Thought is energy placed into motion. It's like putting one foot before the other. So, you know, it made me understand that we must pay attention to what it is that we're thinking, because what we're seeing out in the world is the thoughts of the mass majority of the people. So if we don't want to bring civilization down as we know it, something needs to be done in a hurry. And as to alternative medicine, you know, you hear that old saying that you are your emotions. Well, I understood now when this thing happened what that really means. And I'd like to tell a story to people that I do readings for. You know, have you ever been stopped by a policeman? Of course, you know, everybody's been stopped by a policeman. So when you look in your rearview mirror and you see that blue light in the mirror, you get this funny kind of sick feeling in your gut. Well, now I understand that every single time in your life, if you'll pay attention to this, every single time without fail, if you experience a negative emotion, if you move your focus down to right above your navel to your solar plexus area, you'll find this kind of sick feeling of heightened awareness, and it's neurons firing. You know, Michael Gershon has written a book called Gut, the Second Brain. Well, now we know in science that there are more neurons in the gut than there are in the brain. Neurons are nerve cells, and nerve cells talk. And they send a message, kind of like Morse code, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Goes runs through your autonomic nervous system, and based on Roland McCrady's work at HeartMath, gets to your brain in about 8 milliseconds. Well, the brain interprets those dots and dashes, and in response to it, causes neurotransmitters, neuropeptides, and androgenous chemicals to be released. And because it's related to the Morse code of the body, so to speak, and that gut feeling, every chemical that comes out will be targeted based on a specific emotion, and that specific emotion is going to target a specific organ or system in your body. So if you constantly inundate that specific organ or system in your body with the same negative thoughts every single time about how you react to the world, your perception to the world, you're going to end up sick. For example, once I got this ability, and I started reading people, I realized that 7 out of 10 people that I would read have been touched inappropriately by a caregiver. That's unbelievable numbers. Five out of those seven people, the women would get breast cancer and the men would get prostate or testicular cancer. And it's just, I've never been wrong about it. So, you know, if you learn to forgive, and it's not saying that it's okay that happened to you, it's not okay that someone hurt you, regardless of what the hurt is in the world, whether somebody drops a bomb in your backyard. It's how you react to that thing that's going to make you sick. So learning to forgive or let it go, okay, that happened, and stay in the moment, and not what was 5 minutes ago or not what might be 5 minutes from now. Mm-hmm. You can be a healthy, thriving, happy human being. I hope that makes sense.
Well, yes, it does. And in some ways, you're talking about the same central message that that many teachers have given throughout the ages. And one of the most recent examples of that, of course, is Eckhart Tolle and his work and his emphasis on the power of now, for people to be present right now in the moment and not to get trapped and lost in our stories, which is not to deny the history that we have, but to recognize that we are more than our history, that right now consciousness is active in the present moment, and one of the values of consciousness is that it can make choices, it can create intentions, and that always happens right now in the present moment, and that's where our power lies, is to focus our awareness and our consciousness in the present moment, and from that moment to create intention. And that's how we then begin to make change and manifest in the world around us. And that's what you've just been talking about. I'd like to just go back a little bit, though, and ask you if you could say just a little bit more about the experiences that you had in that turning point dream or sleep. I don't even know if it was
I don't know
dream.
What to call it either. But
yeah.
What happened, or the things that I learned was when I went to the other side, my father was standing there. Well, first of all, when he came to me, I went, "What are you doing here? You're dead." And he said, "Well, you know, sometimes if there's something important you need to take care of, God lets you come back. And I didn't get to tell you that I loved you." Because what I left out was that I met a Jewish man and married this Jewish man. And you know, I grew up in the South where racism ran high. Whether it was a Jew or a black, they didn't like people that were different from themselves. And I grew up where in a Baptist church, one like Mayberry. You know, if you've ever watched Andy Griffin, the town where I grew up was like that.
Wow.
So we were taught that there was a burning hell and a heaven. And when you died, you went to one of those two places, and that was it. So that was the only thing that I have ever been exposed to. And when I met the Jewish man, actually converted, but we only really learned about the holidays, the Jewish holidays, and how to keep kosher. We never got into the afterlife. So I didn't have any conditioning, is my point, when this dream thing happened. So the next instant, I was on the other side, and he was standing there in front of me, and he was pointing at this thing that looked somewhat like an organizational chart, like a corporate organizational chart.
Uh-huh.
And I need to say, now I understand that everything that I saw and learned over there, it's not really this way, but I had to have it presented in a way that I could comprehend it. So he was pointing at this chart, and he said, "What I want you to understand is that I didn't raise you the right way. There's no burning hell, unless you think there is, because everything is about what you think. But that's not really the way it is. There's duality. There's darkness, and there's light. Light contains information, and that information is everything that has existed in time, space as we know it, in experience." And he said, "But the point of this is you start out down here," and he pointed at the bottom of this organizational chart and said, "Every time you learn a life lesson, you bump up a notch. And the point, and God is up here at the top, or the force, or the source, or the feel, whatever you want to call it, is at the top, the ultimate energy, whatever you want to call that thing. And so every time you're down here, and every time you learn a life lesson, you bump up a notch. And life, it's important to understand that life lessons are different than karma. Karma is that thing that you experience from the choices that you make in your life. Life lessons are simply the lessons that you learn. And every soul, when they incarnate into a physical body, chooses a handful of life lessons that they want to learn in this incarnation. For example, one might want to know love. Well, there are many aspects of love, so you want to learn love by a child, or God may want to know how it feels to be, 50 and have 3 kids and have one of them kidnapped and be a single parent at 50 years old. Or God may want to know what it feels like to be black and, having babies at 16 and having to live in Africa without enough food. So you have to learn all of the perspectives of everything that is that's out there at some point in your life. And the only way that you can do that is through incarnating into a physical body, because everything, there is no serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine floating out in space, and those things are emotions. Those are what constitute emotions. So without something for the God force to incarnate into, there's only observation. There's no experiencing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. There's certainly no way to take action unless the consciousness is embodied. And
yes.
So that's how intentions get manifested, is through the actions we take through our embodiment.
Yes. It was like that. And so then there were the normal things that any other person that in a near-death experience would ask. Have you seen this person? Have you seen that person? And he told, grandparents or relatives or whatever, and he told me about that. Then he told me that my mother was going to die in the next 5 years, and what would happen to her soul depended on the choices that she made in this short period of time that she was left to be here. And she did die within the next 5 years. And then he said, I got to go now and I won't be back. And I said, is there anything that I need to do? Well, first of all, I said, am I doing all the things I'm supposed to be doing? And he laughed and he said, yes. I said, is there anything that I'm not doing that I need to do? And he said, yes. And I said, he said, but I can't tell you what it is because those are the choices that you have to make. And he showed me something, and I can feel it, but it's the of the things I was supposed to do, but it's the only part of the dream that I can't remember.
Mm.
So I woke up the next morning, and I thought that it had been 3 days that this experience lasted, and of course it was only overnight. And I woke up, you know, different with this ability, but I also woke up in bliss. And at last, I felt, and I hate to describe it this way, but words are limited. It's like having an orgasm without the sex. You know, that electromagnetic, I don't know how to describe it, but that really wonderful feeling that comes with it, but without the sexual feelings attached. It was just
right. Love.
It felt literally like I was walking about 6 inches off the ground, like some kind of magnetic field or something,
mm-hmm.
for about 6 months. And that gradually subsided. And bliss, I mean, I can't tell you how the bliss was. It was like looking through a new, or suddenly being able to see and having never seen before.
Yes.
It was the best thing that had ever happened to me. I hate that feeling subsides, but it still leaves you with the knowing
mm-hmm.
and the growth, even though the feeling subsides. And occasionally there will be a glimpse of that, but just not with the intensity like it was at the very beginning.
Yeah, I'm sure that what you've just described is, again, familiar to at least some, if not many, of your listeners, is that moment of transformation that comes with that sense of, it's like somebody's just turned the lights on for the first time.
And somebody's home finally.
That too, yes. And it's as if up until that moment, you know, life had been lived in black and white or just very faded colors, and now it was vibrantly alive with neon vibrating colors, and life just has that vibrational quality to it that is very, very different, and it comes with that sense of, as you said, bliss, and it's just such a wonderful experience, and then it begins to fade because life continues to happen, and the experience begins to recede, and then the problem begins is when we then try to recapture that moment of transformation, and we can never do that. What's happening at those times is we are now focusing our attention back on the past, and of course, the key to all of this work is to be present right now in the present moment, and that includes accepting the fact that that moment of bliss has now begun to fade, and to recognize that transformation is not just a one-time event, but that actually it's a process. And it's a process that includes accepting the fact that the bliss may recede and that other experiences, other emotions may begin to come to the surface again, whether it's anger, depression, sadness, whatever it might be. They're just part of the process too, no less valid than the bliss, and we have to accept all of that. I'm just wondering if that fits with your experience.
Well, one thing I would like to say about that before I forget is that I figured out there are two ways to enlightenment. Well, three. I guess you can be born that way. You can be born awake. But there's the kind where it's boom, like an atomic bomb going off with me, and there's the other kind where it's inching forward in gradients. You know, you gradually wake up throughout your lifetime, but you never really have that boom experience. But it doesn't make it any less valid than the boom experience. In fact, you're kind of lucky, because I think the reason, when I think about it, and I think about this stuff a lot, when you have one of these boom experiences, it's because polarities. You know, you've lived life wildly to one extreme, so your energy doesn't stop, it just changes form. So to whatever extreme you've been to one side, you're kind of guaranteed to go at the other side. So it's like a pendulum swinging. So it's a good thing and a bad thing. But also, it made me understand that just because I was awake now doesn't mean that I don't still get angry, and it doesn't mean that, you know, I don't have depression, because it's a known fact for people that know me that I suffer depression, and people tend to say, how can you have depression? You know, you say that you had an enlightenment experience. Well, you know, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. I did have that experience, but I do still suffer depression sometimes. But that doesn't make it, just because you have the experience doesn't mean you're not going to have bad things happen in your life because you're not driving the car. You know, God's driving the car. But what you, and that leads up to a question about free will. You know, do we have complete free will? No, I don't have complete free will. Now that I'm aware of it, when I first woke up, I thought, I'd said to my friend Satyam Nadeem one day, I can manifest anything I want, because that's generally what comes when somebody has one of these boom experiences. You go through your gradients a lot faster. And that's when he told me his story about the little yellow steering wheel that we talked about the other day in your interview.
Yeah.
And so I had to think about that for a long time, and I realized, you know, I don't have free will to do anything. I don't have free will to create something. I have free will to subtly manipulate energies. I can subtly manipulate mass and physical reality, because we know that energy is subtle and has subtle effects, like Bob John's work with the ping pong balls. But what I do have complete free will to do is, how am I going to respond to this depression? How am I going to respond to this bad thing that happens in my life, like my daughter, what I told you earlier about my daughter? You know, I can be in the absolute moment, not worrying about what happened yesterday or not worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow, but what is exactly in this moment, like a Nickelodeon that you're turning and you see one screen at a time. So when I get depressed right now, I don't go and act on it, though I would love to sometime, because it makes me not want to be here. But I literally stop myself and go, okay, Eva, literally turn your head around where you are and look around. What has changed? Nothing. You know, I'm still sitting here looking at my computer screen. I still have the trees in my front yard. My house still stands. My kid's still at school that I have to pick up at 2:30. You know, whatever, what has changed since 5 minutes ago when the depression came upon me? Nothing. It's a chemical thing. We don't really exist. So what I do now, instead of reacting to it and sobbing and whining and complaining and moaning, I hold on with my fingernails till it passes, because it will pass.
Yeah, it will pass.
Yeah,
you mentioned two things. I'd like to, just for your listeners' sake, for you to talk about them a little bit more explicit. You mentioned the story about the yellow steering wheel, and you referenced that. We talked about that in your interview with me some time ago. But you probably want to retell that story for the benefit of your listeners. And then you also mentioned an incident that happened with your daughter. Again, just to clear up those two mysteries, perhaps if you'd like to just take a few moments to talk about both of those stories.
Well, I talk about a little yellow steering wheel because and every single person that I talk to that is what I call an active seeker, and if we talk about, I don't know how to describe that except to use David Hawkins' work. Are you familiar with that book, Power versus Force?
Yeah.
You know how he describes it by numbers, 0 to 100, 101 to 200, and so forth? You know, every person, you can kind of look at them when they're first starting to wake up on Hawkins scale, like 3 to 350. They're going to every guru. They're going to every seminar. They're going to every class, reading every book, trying to make themselves become enlightened. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. You can't do it. There's no button to push to make you have some kind of spontaneous enlightenment. It happens when you're ready, and it happens when you learn the lessons you're supposed to learn. And if you don't listen to those lessons, I'm here to tell you, and I could tell you stories all night long, that consciousness will literally take a baseball bat and knock your feet out from under you to get you to listen, because it's always there. It's a knowing. You feel it, or you wouldn't be seeking. So what you really should be doing, instead of going out and seeking every guru or every this or every that who can't do anything for you except to tell you to be still and listen, is to stop and be still. Literally, enlightenment can only come, in my perspective, to the same degree that you give yourself silence to allow it to come, silence of mind.
Don't forget to tell the story, though.
That's right. So I tell this story that you're a two-year-old sitting in the back seat of a car, and you're strapped in a car seat with a little yellow steering wheel. And God or Source or your mother, whoever you want, higher power, is in the front seat driving the car. Yeah. So you're approaching a four-way stop, and the playground's on the right, and the grocery store is on the left. Well, the two-year-old obviously wants to go to the playground, and the person in the front seat wants to go to the grocery store. Whose steering wheel is going to turn? Source, your mother, the higher power, whoever that is. That's the steering wheel that's going to work. So do you have complete free will to drive that car? No. But what you do have complete free will over doing is, how are you going to respond to that steering wheel not working and not going the way that you want it to go?
Right.
You can accept it. Okay. We're not going to the playground today. Or you can pitch a fit. And who suffers if you pitch a fit? You do. Because if that's your mother driving the car, she's going to switch your legs until you, you know, stop. So that's what you have control over, is how you're going to react to that thing that happens in your life that doesn't feel good to you. As to my daughter, ooh, that was a hard one. 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago, I can't remember now because, you know, time doesn't exist. It just kind of flies by. My daughter, who is 16, she suffers depression like her mother, and she... Unlike her mother, she was kind of born spiritually awake. I mean, maybe I was, I don't know, but she hasn't had the boom experience. But it's enough so that she knows she's different and she doesn't fit in with the average kid in her school. And, it, you know, it makes life hard on her. And plus, we've had some things in our life that are hard to deal with. My husband abandoned us and left the country and took everything that we had and never came back, and we didn't know he was going. So sometimes that creeps up on her, and she gets depressed. Well, she, in the last 6 months, unbeknownst to me, she had started fooling around with street drugs. And she, one of these depression spells hits her, because if, you know, you understand, I'm sure, it comes and goes. It's like tide. It ebbs and flows. And when it overtakes you, sometimes you get caught in a hole. And she took some pills, and I went up, and I didn't know it. She, in the middle of the night, she took my car and wrecked it and went and bought some drugs, some Roxycontin. So check on your kids if you have kids in school, because that's the new thing, and it causes respiratory failure. So I got up the next morning and went up to her room to get her up to go to school, and she was dead. She was gray, she was cold, and she was not breathing. I mean, she might as well have been in a morgue. And so I went into, you know, survival mode and gave her CPR all the way to the hospital. She had to have CPR. She wouldn't breathe on her own, and she stayed on a respirator for 3 days. And finally she came around, and today she's okay. But one thing I learned from that, it's two things that I learned from that experience, was if this had happened to me 5 years ago, I'm telling you, I would have committed suicide if I'd have walked up there and found my daughter dead. Mm. I know I would have. But today in my life, when it happened, I went, okay, this happened. And I didn't completely lose control. I acted in the moment what I just needed to do and did that thing. And when the ambulance whisked her off to the hospital, the police came to my house and my boyfriend went to the hospital with her. And I just sat here. Now, what would I have done if she actually died? I can't say. But what I can say is that I wasn't sobbing and losing control because of what I learned in consciousness to be in only the moment, because that was the only thing that existed for me. The second thing that I learned was that when she was in ICU and on this machine, the nurses told me anytime this machine has a readout of 15, it means that she's not breathing on her own if it's 15 or below. Well, she never breathed on her own at all, except when I sat by her. I mean, she was in a coma, and I'd say, honey, this is Mommy. You're my lifesaver. You're Mommy's lifeguard. You have very powerful lungs, and you're at that pool every day, and you're saving people, and I know that you're a strong girl, and you can take a breath for Mommy. Whenever I would do that, she would start breathing, and the number would go from 15 up to 24, and she would breathe. So something's going on there. And then as soon as I would stop, she would go back to not breathing and just be strictly in the coma. So it tells me that there's some conscious awareness going on there, even though she wasn't breathing on her own. So if that happens to you or your loved one, know that they hear you. Talk to them. You know, if you know they're going to die, if you know that thing, talk to them about crossing over and being in the light, and talking to them about being in peace and that they're loved and that everything's okay, because they hear you.
How is she today?
She's great. Yeah. As I think I told you, I called. The first thing I did while she was in the ER is I got on the phone with Norm Shealy and I emailed my friends at Jeff Mishlove's in-present group and everybody that I knew and said, please start your prayer circles. And she, after 3 days, she just popped awake and said, what am I doing here? Where am I? What's going on? And she's fine. It's amazing. I mean, it really is. And another thing, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's a very powerful story and very dramatic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It taught me a lot. It really did. Especially to not give up hope. And even if your loved one is going to, you know they're going to die for whatever reason, they hear what you're saying. Help them die in peace. That's an important thing. Because when you do die, another thing that I learned when I had that experience, the only thing that happens is your physical body drops away. You don't even know that you're dead for a little bit, because your body may fall to the floor, but you're still sitting there. You only realize you're dead when you see the expression on the other people's face, or you look down and see your body fell down on the floor. Mm-hmm. So everything's about mind. It matters how you cross over.
So, through your experiences, what have you learned about intention and manifestation?
Well, I know my experience has been, I won't say that I know, I'll just tell you my experience has been. When this thing first happened and I thought that I was going to save the world, that I knew everything, I realized I didn't know anything at all. And that's when I realized that when I was really on my way down the road. I thought that I could manifest anything that I wanted. But what I have found out that when I have my field very, very cohesive, when my, and I don't know what word to use, whether it's the aura or what it is, but it's that electromagnetic field around us. When I am totally in the moment, and one of the tools that I use, are you familiar with the Siluron lamp that's out?
I'm not, no.
It's the PEAR group, you know, at Princeton. It's the group of scientists that were there. Yeah. They've made this lamp that's really like a small unit of the random event generator.
Okay.
Except what it does is it oscillates through colors of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Uh-huh.
And when it gets non-random, it literally sits and rotates through the colors of the rainbow, just rotates. And when it gets non-random and gets stuck on one color for a long time, I sit down here in my office, and when I'm in a meditative state or writing something or intensely focused, I don't know how to get that across. It must be intensely focused. You must be in low theta or high delta, and how does somebody know that? I don't know how to tell you except to use a lamp or something like this. You know you're really in that state when this lamp stops being random.
I see.
Things happen to me a lot faster. Mm. I mean, I can think about something. It'll come in my, it might be money, it might be a person, it might be some kind of thing. It will come to me very quickly. It may not be in the form that I was expecting it to come, but I will get what I need within the time that I get it. But only when I find myself doing my meditation very cohesive. Does that make sense? It's so hard to describe that.
Yes, that sense of groundedness and just being present to what's happening,
yeah.
And what is.
But it's kind of like, you know, when you were in junior high school, you and I were in junior high school, and we didn't have air conditioning, and it's after lunch, and it's hot, and you're sitting there staring out the window, and you have absolutely no thought. You're just kind of floating. That's the state. When you feel that, you know that you're in that state.
Yeah.
And that's when it creates a lot faster. But just randomly walking around every day, I don't think it happens at all. Dean Radin describes it as having 100 people around a lake, and you want to get all the water out of the lake. If every single person has a rock and the rock's the exact same size, and every single person throws it in at the exact same moment with the exact same force and the exact same momentum, the water's going to come out. If every person just randomly throws a rock in there, you're going to have a bunch of splashes and nothing's going to happen but a big mess. And that's what I think about thought. That's what I tell people about prayer, too. You know, I hear people and they pray these prayers for 30 minutes and it's like all over the place. What are you trying to do? You know, are you trying to hit a dartboard with one dart? And I mean, with a million darts and you can't get them all fitted into the center if you're doing it that way. It's got to be short, focused, intention to get the most result.
Right.
I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah. So can you say a little bit what intention means to you and how to generate it?
Well, I think that intention is both unconscious and conscious. I think that everything that runs through your mind is intending. I think that chattering through brain runs horizontally across your mind if you think about like a ticker tape. And everything that crosses on that ticker tape is an intention whether you like it or not. It may be subconscious and you may not know it, but it's still intending. So if you get in a state of it where you're very cohesive and you're angry and you're thinking all these negative thoughts and you're bringing that into yourself, I tell a story. You know, if you don't like black horses, don't constantly think, I don't want a black horse, I don't want a black horse, because consciousness doesn't understand I don't want. It just understands black horse. So you manifest a black horse in your life that you don't want. And it may come in the form of a black Ford Mustang with a lot of horsepower that runs into your car. You know, if your intention is not focused and very acute, then it manifests somewhere in the world and you have to go find the pieces and put them together like a puzzle. So if you really want something, spend time being extremely focused and thinking only that thought, because otherwise it just gets mixed in with all the other things and never really happens the way you need it to happen. Did that answer the question?
It does, and I'm just noticing we have about 10 minutes left, how time flies.
Thank you.
So two other topics I'd like us to cover in the remaining time, and they're just little topics. I'm joking, of course. Love and God. I'd like to hear you talk about love and then talk about God, what those two ideas, words, concepts mean to you. What experiences do you have in relation to love?
I'd like to talk about God first, if that's okay.
Very good. Yeah.
I think one of the things that that was my experience when this event occurred was that there is no mass on the quantum level. And depending on which scientists I interview on any given weekend, I will get, yeah, you're correct, there's no mass on the level, or the scientist I interviewed last weekend is like, that's all there is mass. What do you mean there's no mass? Don't you see it? Don't you feel it? Well, if we had a microscope strong enough to go down and look at the nucleus of an atom, and then look at that, or that electron, a single electron in an atom, what we would find is, and the reason I use electrons, because that's the thing that makes up mass or electrons, we wouldn't find any mass at all. We would find a lot more particles stuck together with a sticky substance made up of hydrogen mostly and other things. Interestingly, hydrogen being the most abundant and the most powerful element known to mankind, sticking together other particles that makes that electron appear to be mass. So if we looked at those particles, we would only find more particles stuck together, and we'd finally get down to what we call the irreducible unit. Some people like to say that's a zero-point field. You know, I don't know what it is. I don't really care what it is. I just know that it's a force, and it's powerful because it's made up mainly of hydrogen. So if there's no mass on the quantum level, and if it's whatever there is down there on the quantum level, if that's made up of hydrogen, then that's got to be the force behind everything that is, the original intention, the source of creativity. That is that thing. And since there's nothing that separates anything from anything else, since there is no mass, that means we are that thing. So we are God with the knowing taken away. That's my opinion. That's my perspective. How can it? I mean, I can see it. If you can see it, it exists. If you can see it, if you could just let your mind go deep enough, you can see that thing. So if you feel unworthy, if you feel like you're not deserving, or you can't do this, you can, you know, you are that thing. You are the source of all there is, just with the knowing taken away briefly.
Uh-huh. Just in case there are any scientists or people who are educated about science listening into this, just want to clear one thing up. It sounded like you were saying that hydrogen is what holds electrons together. From a scientific perspective, that can't be the case, because hydrogen is made up of electrons and protons. And so just wanted to clear that one up. That I'm not sure if you have something else in mind, but hydrogen cannot be more fundamental than the things that compose it, which are electrons and protons. And it may not be all that important or relevant, but I just did want to not let that one slip by in case.
Well, I think that it is important, and unfortunately I'm limited by my language.
Yeah.
But I know that it may be another form of hydrogen that we've not yet discovered, but I also know that hydrogen is very sticky and causes things to stick together. So I don't know how to answer that because I'm limited in my language and I'm just a woman. So I have to try to describe the best way that I can to what I see. But I know that obviously, there are other things. Nothing is 100% hydrogen, or we wouldn't be able to exist.
Well, what might be interesting for you to take a look at is scientists do talk about something that's deeper than the subatomic level that they call gluons. Now, gluons do hold the nucleus together inside an atom. So perhaps that might be a term for you to look into rather than hydrogen at that level. It might be gluons. However, I would also caution anyone attempting to try to explain God or spirit in terms of physics. There's a real temptation in our culture to valorize science and the language of science and to use it in areas where it's actually inappropriate. And for example, talking about consciousness or God or spirit, I don't think we need to turn to the language of science to validate those experiences.
I think, you know, I don't know how to answer that question, Christian. All I know is that when this happened to me, I've never had a physics class in my life, ever. And the next morning when I woke up, I knew things like the Seth material, physics from that perspective,
yeah.
If you've read the Seth material. And why would it come to me? I think maybe it will lead us, there's too many people thinking that religion's important. Religion causes wars. So since we've been conditioned by science since we were literally in preschool, the only thing that's for the people who aren't going to have these boom experiences or for the people that aren't already on their spiritual path is for science to give them some hope that, uh-oh, there's something more to this picture that I need to look at. There's something more to this picture for reasons that I need to treat other people like I want to be treated. I mean, I can't do anything but go back to the irreducible unit, whatever you want to call that thing, when it gets down to nothing but the energy. And the thing that the energy sits on, which is intention of some sort, an intention of love, and I don't mean love like you love your husband, I just mean where everything is perfect and your eyes are open and you're smiling and your heart feels good, whatever you want to call that thing.
From the perspective of science, the irreducible unit may be what scientists would call the quantum. A good friend of mine, he's no longer with us, Arthur Young, spoke about the quantum as a packet of purposeful action. And that's a pretty good description of the irreducible unit that is both the carrier of what gives rise to the physical world, to the material world, but also to the world of consciousness and intention. So the irreducible unit, I would propose, at least to consider as being a contender, a candidate, is the quantum of action. It's a quantum of purposeful, intentional action.
You know, that sits on something, though, and that's where I lack, where we lack words. If you lay down, and I had this experience one day, and I actually picked up the phone and called Claude Swanson and said, Claude, what is this thing? I was sitting in a parking lot waiting on my oil to be changed, and there was a little grassy area, and I was laying there looking with my kids, and if you stare hard enough, you can see these little squiggly things in the air. Do you know what I'm talking about?
By the way,
I think
we just
I do.
Have to close soon.
All right. Okay. That my producer broke in. We've got only another minute. But you can see these squiggly things. I think that's the quanta packet, and they still sit on something. What? I don't know, but they sit on something. Some kind of... I don't know, but that's what I call the irreducible unit, where there's nothing else but the original energy, whatever that is. Anyway, we have to go now. Why don't you tell it? My website is www.evaher.com. And Quincy, why don't you tell us yours?
Okay.
One more time where people can find you.
It's www.christiandequincy.com.
Thank you for doing this for me.
You're very welcome.
I'm grateful. Thank you. And have a good evening.
Thanks. And you too, and to your listeners. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher.
author of Integral Health.
Integral Health. Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health.
Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.